Reading from the Jiva Dharma, Chapter 9.
Nitya Dharma and Material Science. I believe that's the chapter. I don't see the title here. Omigyanatimarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Taksur Mulitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupakadamayam Dati Sapadantikam Vansha Kalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Srivata Devgaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna Krishna, Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama Rama, Rama, Hare Hare So greetings from New York. Glad to be back with the Sangha members. And I was just traveling and wasn't able to give class. So we're studying Jiva Dharma, which is discussing Nitya Dharma, which is the eternal duty of the living entity. And human life, spiritual life, real life, is meant to get to the soul. There's the soul, there's the swarup, and there's the yatarupam, there's the false ego. And spiritual life is when you actually come to the point of the soul. And the Nitya Dharma means your eternal duty. When so many different situations that change, and in those situations in different bodies and different genders, in different ages, in different occupations, in different situations, we have different duties, but they change. They're not mitika dharma, they're temporary, but this is the eternal dharma. And real life is to actually find that. That's what self-realization is. Because unless you find your nature and the duty according to your real nature, then one could never be satisfied. And that's really what dharma is. Even naimittika dharma are those activities, even if they're temporal, that will actually move you towards understanding the real self. So it's kind of the theme of the book. And the book reveals, in terms of people who come, according to one's situation, people have different conceptions and ideas about what's one's real duty. And when you have misconceptions, you come to a saintly person who's situated in his eternal relationship with Krishna, and that person can help you understand the self. There's nothing more important than self-realization, because without understanding the self, you can never be happy. Because happiness is congruence between our lives and our between who we are and what we do. So unless you know who you are, then you can never be line up your life according to your real nature. And you'll always be acting against nature. You'll always be suffering. So Jiva Dharma is such an interesting book, just the way Bhaktivinoda Thakur thought of it, of people being, you know, the setting of Godrum Deep, which is the one of the islands of Navadvip, which is the place of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and it's the island of Kirtan. And in the kunjas of that, the flower forest bowers, there are great Paramahamsas, the generation after Lord Chaitanya. And it's the story of people coming to Krishna consciousness. And I mentioned this many, many times, that according to your present conceptions, you need a particular truth of Krishna consciousness clarified. So the Jiva Dharma covers all tattvas, all subjects of Krishna consciousness. We're at the point now where one of the people who came, who was from a aristocratic Brahmin family, a landowner, and towards the end of his life, he had somehow by good fortune met these sages, and now he's, after staying there despite the objections of his family, he becomes liberated. And now we're at the point, because he's an elderly man, where his best friend from youth, who's named Digambar, and his best friend, who is working in another state, comes home and he finds that his friend had become a Vaishnava. And especially after Lord Chaitanya's, the Vaishnavism had become so pure. And totally eclipsed by upper sampradayas and all kinds of misconceptions, because somehow it was lost. So Vaishnavism did not have a very strong reputation. So he was really upset, his friend, who was a Shakta. Shakta means basically they worship the goddess Durga, the material energy, and their conception of liberation is mistakenly very, very materialistic. And we see that even in the modern world. What do people think is our duty? They think it's materialistic, and you know, they don't really have knowledge of the soul, or it's nationalistic, or it's militaristic, or materialistic, and they don't really have a vision of the soul. So he's very upset, and he comes to, Digambar comes to see his friend, who's now in Dwaita. And they begin that. He's very nasty, because he has no respect for Vaishnavism. And he's very much a materialist, but thinking that that's spiritual life. And people could think that sex life is spiritual life. You know, family life is spiritual life, or it's life. So, so many misconceptions. So we asked them, what is civilization and what is science? They're having an argument, and Advaita Das, presenting the Vaishnava conceptions, gives the Sanskrit word for civilization, which is sabhyata. Literally means sabhyata, fitness to participate in a sabha. And what is real civilization? It's a virtuous civilization. It's a civilization which people are free from selfishness and sin. And he says that's only found in Vaishnavism. It's really found in spiritual life. And simple, you know, just clean cloth and simple food to keep yourself together, where this Digambar worships the material energy. So he thinks that civilization is dressing fine and eating fine. But Digambar, like most materialists, thinks that, you know, heaven on earth is materialist civilization. You think most modern people, even though they claim to be Christians or whatever their religion is, what do they think heaven is? What do they work for when they become charge of government? That everyone should have internet access. What will people use that access for? Everyone should have the cars. We should, you know, we should have petroleum and gas for everyone in the world. And it's Maya Sukaya. It's the illusion of happiness. That type of happiness is not happiness at all. It even can distract one from the soul. They did happiness indexes. Countries that were very simple, like Bangladesh, had people were very, very happy, or more happy than other countries, which were, you know, materially advanced. So we'll read now that this Advaita, he's responding that the Digambar, his friend, who said that the Vaishnavs have no interest in Vigyan. And by Vigyan, he's experiential realized knowledge. But really, Vigyan also to Digambar means science. And he says, no, it's not true. The pure knowledge of the Vaishnava is endowed with Vigyan. And he quotes from the Chaturshloki Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, Jnanam Paramam Guyam Mayad Vigyana Sambhitam. That ultimately knowledge is non-dual, in the sense that everything is part and connected to the same thing. And it has four distinct divisions. And one of those is Vigyan. Before this creation, Bhagavan was pleased with Brahma's worship and instructed him on the tenets of pure Vaishnav Dharma. Bhagavan said, O Brahma, I am explaining to you this most confidential knowledge of myself, which is endowed with realization, which contains the mystery of praying, which is composed of the under the sadhana bhakti. Accept this of me. Digambar, there are two types of knowledge, Shudigyan, pure knowledge, and Vishayagyan, knowledge of material objects. So you can have knowledge of material objects, their composition, but spiritual knowledge is to understand something deeper, not just the composition of the object, but ultimately what it is. What's its sambandha? What's its relationship to reality? Just understanding what something is doesn't help you to understand its relationship to reality. I always tell that story when I got kidnapped by Ted Patrick and my parents. I have a whole story. They tried to commit me to a mental institution. But of course, they had to see the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist spoke to my parents first, but then the psychiatrist had some doubts about me because I was waiting in the hospital lobby with all the crazy people. And because I got kidnapped from a temple, I didn't yet have really Western clothes. So what I put on was kind of very baggy. The pants were baggy before they were fashionable. My brother's football jacket, some kind of crazy hat. I was chanting rounds, which you can do by a combination of the sections on the hands of both hands. You can count. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. There's 12 sections in your fingers, excluding your thumb. So on one hand, you go through 12. On the other hand, the 12 can be used as a counter. I mean, you get 9 times 12. You do it 9 times. You have 16 hours. So I was sharing my rounds on my fingers. So the psychiatrist thought I was hallucinating, and he asked me, are you hallucinating? Are you seeing anything that's not there, or something like that? And I told him, no, I'm not hallucinating, but it can't be said that I'm seeing the same thing as you. And I gave the example from Prabhupada's books. Just like a rose, Prabhupada said a rose can be material energy, or you can see the rose as separate from God and meant to your own enjoyment. But if you're a devotee, a man of God, you see the rose as God's energy and meant for his enjoyment. So basically, spiritual knowledge, in other words, you still know the rose, you knew that it was red, you knew that it was fragrant, but you didn't know it was God's. So spiritual knowledge is just not an analysis of something, but it's a deeper analysis to understand not just the attributes of something, but the origin of something, the depth of something. It's just like in yoga, you can meditate. First, you can meditate on an object. This is the Yoga Sutras. Then you meditate on an object. Then you meditate on the object without inception. You don't try to input, because that's what the mind does. It identifies an object and it ascribes some feelings to the object. So you don't try to activate the mind. You just try to experience the object without inception. And then you try to even go deeper. And you try to meditate on the object, the core material elements of the object, devoid of any form or shape, just the composition of it. And ultimately, it goes down to prakriti. And it's supposed to be an ecstatic state where the mind is becoming more and more purified. So real knowledge is the deeper understanding of things. Like, there may be an object, but unless you know who owns it, you don't really understand that object. You may understand the things in the object, but you don't understand what that object is. That object is such and such as object. It's his car. It's his iPhone. So he's going to explain this to him, that there are two types of knowledge, shudhagyan, pure knowledge, and vishayagyan, knowledge of material objects. all human beings acquire Vishyagyan through the senses. So knowledge of material objects, but that knowledge is impure. So it's useless to discerning transcendental objects. It is only useful in relation to the jiva's conditioned state of material existence. Knowledge that pertains to spiritual consciousness is known as Shuddhagyan. The highest, the most pure understanding is to see things in relationship to God. And therefore you see God every year. Prabhupada said, just like if you know someone, they have distinct glasses. If you see the glasses, you see the person. So you see everything is connected to God. It is only useful in relationship, okay, that is eternal, and it is the basis of the Vaishnava's worship. Spiritual knowledge is the antithesis of material knowledge and is completely distinct from it. This material knowledge only tells you what an object is in relationship to yourself. Spiritual knowledge tells what an object is in relationship to God. And therefore, your pure relationship with the object as God's energy. You say that he's talking. You say that Vishyagyan is the yet. Is that that's the real high material knowledge? Is the real high thing? He says, but it's not the yet in the true sense of the term. The real reason that your Ayurveda and other types of material knowledge are called vidyan is that they are distinct from pure spiritual knowledge. True vidyan is that pure knowledge that is distinct from material knowledge. There's no difference between yet, which is the knowledge of a truly abiding substance, and vidyan, which is the knowledge of how such an object is distinct from matter. So real gyan understands reality, and reality is a connection to God. You don't really understand something. You really, even if you understand the components of something, you don't really understand something. Unless you understand it as God's energy. Like you may see a person, you may see a body, somebody's body, you may see your body and you may see it as the self. So that's material knowledge. And you may know that it has certain material composition and that it bleeds and it does this thing. But you know, you have so much knowledge of that object, it's material. But if you don't know that it's distinct from the self, or if you don't know that it's not you ultimately, then what type of knowledge do you have? Jnana is this direct perception of a transcendental object. I got to really figure out this sentence. Jnana is direct perception of the transcendental object, whereas vijnana is the establishment of pure knowledge in contrast to material knowledge. Although these two are actually the same, they are known either as jnana or vijnana according to the methods they employ. Anyway, I'm going to speak a little bit. This I got to go over more. But today is the disappearance of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And I should speak something about that. It's always suspicious. This is Tirubhav Titi Mahotsava. And to understand Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, you
you really have to understand the concept of Acharya. And what it really takes to keep knowledge pure. To keep the right understanding of things. There's so many influences that cover the true perception of something. We appropriate so many things for our false ego. You know, we approach religiosity with an agenda. And we create different dogmas and different conceptions based on our attachments. So pure teachings, which is antithetical to the core faith of a living entity in this world, because the core faith of a living entity in this world is to be the enjoyer or controller and see even something as knowledge as the power to control the world, or beauty is the power to control the world. So religion and religious conceptions and pure spirituality is often co-opted or disrespected. So at the time of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, especially Calcutta, which is the birth of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Calcutta was very much influenced by the British. And just as we're reading today, and materialism, what was civilization, what they thought civilization was a very external thing of how people dressed and you know, civilized person is not a sadhu. They don't look at a civilized person as a sadhu. They look at a civilized person as one who really knows how to enjoy, has a high understanding of the material world and how to move in it so that one can enjoy. And then it becomes certain symbols of civilization in terms of tuxedos and, you know, etiquette and so many things. And because the society at the time of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was so influenced by British values, and because Hinduism had been, you know, such Hinduism was not attractive, actually. It became either on one side ritualistic or it just lost respect, and Vaishnavism also lost respect. And Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was able to reestablish the dignity following in the footsteps of his father. Of course, he knew that Indian spirituality had to be redefined, but he also understood it had to be reaffirmed. It had to, you know, he had to communicate it in an attractive way, that there was an intellectual basis of Krishna consciousness and spiritual life, but that it was very, very much representative in the particular time that it's presented of the original principles of Vaishnava culture. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, you know, because Vaishnavism was basically called Chotalok. Chotalok means, you know, like Paralok means big people, Chotalok, very, very small people, basically low class people. So he preached to the intellectual class of people. It's not because he wanted to just enlighten the intellectual class of people. Because, no, but it's because unless they respected Krishna consciousness, it wouldn't be appreciated very highly. But at the same time, he was embracing the universal principles of Krishna consciousness that opened it up to all. So he spoke in very, very high intellect, and it became very, very respected and brought many, many intelligent people into spiritual life. But it's interesting that although he had so vigorous to crush anti-devotional conceptions, and devotional conceptions that had been co-opted for ego and sensual pursuits, he prepared himself. The principle of taste and distribute, he chanted 1 billion names. That's 10 years of 192 rounds a day. I estimate people chanted quite fast, that they maybe finished it in 12 hours. But still, he never wasted a second. That's why in his mutts, he insisted, in his temples, he insisted that everyone chanted 64 rounds, and he was unrelenting. And people couldn't do it because they were so busy in service. But then they understood that his real principle is that you should always be engaged in devotional service. And you'll really make advancement. Spiritual advancement and realization comes when one is concentrated. And Bhaktisiddhanta felt that one of the best ways to be concentrated was to do reasonable service, responsible service. And he just wanted to make sure that people who came to the ashram and monastery that he established, I recommend it to everyone, whether the household is outside, that you're always engaged and that you don't have time for idle talk. And then he was an interesting combination of a revolutionary. You know, he wanted to revolutionize the world, but he also established an institution because he felt to re-spiritualize humanity and to socialize values, you need an institution. That's just, I mean, what's happening now, the benefit, I'm in the Bhakti Center, it's an institution. Not just individual people chanting, but they get together. Because that facilitates the education and of people coming to Krishna consciousness and the communication or outreach of Krishna consciousness and the development of Krishna consciousness, is that community is needed, institution is needed. So he established an institution, but at the same time, He did what the needful, and you know he took sannyas from a picture of Gaurakishore Das Babaji, and he took sannyas. He wore saffron, So he was really criticized for that. You can imagine. But he felt that he needed to, and Prabhupada also felt this, that he needed to have some, to have an institution, he needed to have some social division. And therefore he wanted to recognize people with renunciation and knowledge to be the leaders so that there can actually be a decision-making process where things can actually get done, to get done when you have leaders. So he was very, very much criticized for taking sannyas, but he responded. And he responded that it was actually an act of humility, because from the time of Lord Chaitanya, people who renounced the world were taking bhavaji vesh, just two pieces of white loincloth, basically. They were taking bhavaji vesh. Vesh means dress. So, and that represented a paramahamsa. And levels of renunciation, one of the highest levels is Parivrajakacharya, where you just, Parivrajakacharya, you're the teacher that travels around. That's an expression of dependence on God, because you don't have any set, because you're not living in one house, you don't even have any set protection or food and you experience God's creation and you see how God is providing in a developed state. But the highest is Paramahamsa. And that's what and he just felt in his time it was a sham. The people that took to the Paramahamsa Vesh. He said he did it out of humility, and it's also out of necessity. And his principle was Yukta Vairagya, which means balanced attachment. I think they described his preaching as the chopping technique, because he was very, very powerful. He felt that, you know, he couldn't be touchy-feely. He thought the negative approach was the approach of condemnation. He thought, because there's so many things that are cheating people and misrepresenting Krishna consciousness. We can see that today. So many things that are cheating and misrepresenting Krishna consciousness that he had to clearly distinguish it. And he had to very, very strongly, because he felt that they were cheating people, even though they were established institutions in themselves, he had to strongly condemn them. So his preaching was so vigorous. So vigorous, especially against the Radhakund Babajis. Or the culture within that, because there may be some nice people there, but the culture within that, that people artificially assume a very high spiritual status and a very high spiritual practice before they're actually qualified for it. So Bhakti Siddhanta, you know, because when you offer something cheap, you'll attract innocent people. So Bhakti Siddhanta very, very strongly preached. His name is Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. Siddhanta Saraswati was a name given when he was studying Jyotish, astronomy, in school. Later, when he took sannyas, he just put the name Bhakti before it. So he was Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. You know, it's again, it's late and a little tired. Anybody like to say hello? Anybody say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Gail? I vote. Someone said hello? Someone like to say hello?
Hello, Maharaj. This is Katya.
Katya, so nice to hear from you. Right.
Thank you so much.
Let me know how you're doing, okay?
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, I'm going to take rest now. Hare Krishna.